Blog Talk Radio.
You have tuned in to the Brain Injury Radio Network, with shows 7 nights a week. You can find the network at BrainInjuryRadio.com or look up Brain Injury Radio Network on Facebook.
Welcome to Another Fork in the Road with your host, Donna O'Donnell Fugerski.
Welcome to the Brain Injury Radio Network on blogtalkradio.com. My name is Donna O'Donnell Fugerski, and I am your host on my show, Another Fork in the Road. My show airs on the first and third Sundays of every month at 5:30 p.m. Pacific Time. So you can just slot that into any time zone and tune in to listen to us. Another Fork in the Road is for anyone with a brain injury. Anyone who is caring for a brain injury person, or anyone with any interest in learning more about brain injury. Brain injury is not discriminating. It can happen to anyone, anytime, and anywhere. And I'm sorry to say, it does. It does very, very often. The Brain Trauma Foundation states that there are more than 5 million people in the United States living with some form of brain injury. But most folks do not even know about brain injury. I know I never did, not until it came to live on my doorstep. On Another Fork in the Road, I try to raise awareness of brain injury and to help folks to understand what survivors and caregivers experience. And yes, I did say caregivers. Although the survivor is the one that had the brain injury, caregivers are impacted by this injury as well. And I think you'll find out more as we talk on through the show. On the third Sunday of each month, I interview brain injury survivors or caregivers to see how they traverse their world of brain injury. I host therapists, medical professionals, and authors to gain insight into what they offer survivors. And on each first Sunday of the month, like today, I host a discussion panel to examine pertinent topics related to brain injury, such as depression, neurofatigue, anger, or various other symptoms of brain injury. And there are many, 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 many. We're going to talk a little bit about some of those too today. For those of you who are new to my show, here's just a little snippet about me. I came on the brain injury scene in 2005, so we're going on, it's more than 17 years already. When my husband David had a brain injury. You can learn more about that on my blog, SurvivingTraumaticBrainInjury.com. And you'll be hearing little snippets of things, examples of things during this broadcast as well. But I shared David's and my story in 4 episodes on this very show in August of 2014, and the last of which in November of 2014 featured a discussion with David himself. I wanted to get David's input on his brain injury, because people had already heard my version. So I also interviewed David on my April 19, 2020 show for his perspective on his brain injury after 15 years at that time. And because he is a retired professor of microbiology from Columbia University, I wanted his understanding of the COVID-19 pandemic, because he was doing a lot of research on it from home and from fellow professors that he knows, discussing it with them. So I wanted to get his input to help people to understand what was going on way back then when this all began and we knew nothing of COVID. But we know a lot more now, and some of us know too much of it. Right. You can find my archived shows on my blog at SurvivingTraumaticBrainInjury.com. Just click the On the Air Show menu tab under the category section on the right sidebar. It's easy. Just and once you get there, in the search box, type David Figurski, F-I-G-U-R-S-K-I, or type in David. There are a few other Davids that have interviews there, but you can find him. And again, that's in the search bar on the right sidebar. Search box on the right sidebar. Let's get that straight. All right, so you could also read our complete story in my book, Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Tale, which was published by Right Life Publishing and released in November 2018. You can find Prisoners, as I so fondly call it, as a print book and an ebook, and most recently as an audiobook, which is read by me. I was fortunate enough to be able to read the story, and it's published on Amazon, Apple. Just just pop it in to your Google or whatever your search engine is, and check it out. So you can also find it, at all your local book hunts or the library. And if they don't have it, ask for it. They can order it. It's easy. When you read it, please write a review on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Goodreads, because a review is a book's best friend. And it helps to let others know about a good read. And in our world of the brain injury community, we want to share this information, all the information that we get about any books, any podcasts that we do or have, because we want to help other people. And some people don't even know that they're going to need this help, but many of them will, which is unfortunate. So go to my website, DonnaFigurski.com. That's DonnaFigurski.com. And you can learn a lot about me, a ton about me, more than you may ever want to know about me. But check it out. You can always clip out. So I hope that you find my show tonight fun and informative, and I hope that you'll visit the shows of the other hosts on Brain Injury Radio, because there are shows every night between 7 and 10 p.m. Pacific time. And you can also tune in on the weekends at 5:30 p.m. Pacific time to listen to your favorite shows, too. So Brain Injury Radio airs across the United States and in 36 countries. So relax and enjoy the show. Today's show is going to be about helping folks to understand what it's like to live with a brain injury. And we're talking about what it's like to live with a brain injury as a survivor and as a caregiver or a family member or a friend. Because, as I said earlier, brain injury affects more than just the survivor. And we're going to talk about that and see just how it does and how we might offer some ways that we have done, some advice or whatever that might help you out there. So as a survivor of brain injury, you're trying to figure out how to live with your injury. It's confusing. It's devastating. It's definitely frustrating. And for many, it's even incomprehensible. It takes baby steps along the road of healing to figure out your new life. Be patient, they say, but when life and healing are moving at a snail's pace, it's near impossible to be patient. How, when it is so hard for the survivor and caregiver to understand brain injury, can they possibly relate their feelings and help others to understand? It's a perplexing problem, and I are going to delve into this topic. And hopefully we'll be able to shed some light on the subject, at least from our perspectives, because brain injury affects everyone differently. So first, I want to introduce you to my guest. Megan Beaudry developed lupus in 2009, which caused a brain inflammation. And she has become a patient advocate for lupus. And you can learn more about lupus at lupus.net. Megan began writing as part of her rehabilitation from her brain trauma in 2014, and she simply never stopped. Her work has been published in Hippocampus, Ravishly, Folks at PillPack, Al Jazeera, and the Huffington Post. When Megan's not writing, she can be found cuddling with her rescue dogs. Oh, I can so relate to that. because I now have a rescue dog that has just been with me for a year, and those cuddles are precious. So I get what you're saying there, Megan, and I've seen your pup, so I get it totally. She also likes drinking bubble tea and teaching students ages, wait a minute, listen to this, teaching students ages 3 to 93 to play the violin. Pretty interesting. 3 is so young to be even holding a violin, and yet Megan has accomplished that. And a 93-year-old, too. Wow. Don't underestimate those oldsters, people. They can do a lot of things. So you can read about Megan on my blog, survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. And in the search box, just as I did it with David, told you about David, type her name, Megan Beaudry. It's M-E-G-H-A-N. And her last name is B-E-A-U, almost like beautiful. B-E-A-U-D-R-Y. A Survivor Speak Out interview will pop up, and so will a show from Another Fork in the Road, from March 21st to 2021, on which Megan appeared. So you can learn a whole lot about Megan because that show was totally focused on her. Since then, Megan has been on many panels on Another Fork in the Road, so check her out. And you can follow Megan on Twitter at MeganBeaudry1, .com. MeganBeaudry1.com. So welcome, Megan. I'm so glad to have you back tonight.
Thanks. I'm glad to be back.
Okay. And I want to give a big hello to Elizabeth Bonifeed, who I want to welcome back to Another Fork in the Road. And I have to say, we've missed you, Elizabeth, for years, the caregiver for her ex-husband, Frank, a police officer, who was in a serious crash, which resulted in Frank's brain injury. Elizabeth is also a speech therapist and an author. Her book, 27 Miles, The Tank's Journey Home, is the account of Frank's and her experiences after his brain injury. You can also learn more about Elizabeth in her latest book, Dying to Live Your Life. I love that title. It's on her website at ElizabethMackle.com, and I'll spell that out for you. I hope you guys all have pencils and paper next to you, because I do throw out a lot of URLs. ElizabethMackle.com. Check out Elizabeth's past shows on SurvivingTraumaticBrainInjury.com. And again, that's another URL, survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com, all lowercase, but it doesn't have to be. So type her name in the search bar, and you can learn more about Elizabeth. So Elizabeth, welcome back. It's so nice to have you here.
Well, thank you. It is good to be back.
Great. So are you guys ready to get started?
Absolutely.
I am.
Definitely.
Okay. All right. So my first little thing here is many doctors set a limited timeline for improvements after brain injury. And countless survivors have proven them wrong. There really is no set limit for overcoming brain injury. It's as random as a fingerprint or a snowflake. No two brain injuries are alike. Unlike a broken bone, which a doctor can declare will heal in 6 weeks, brain injuries are unique. Depending on the damage done and what part of the brain was affected, will determine how much healing can take place and how long it may take or what kind of damage was done. It is said that most folks cannot completely heal after brain injury, but they may be able to regain much of their former self. It's individual. Like I said, snowflake, fingerprint. It's individual, and it really does depend on where in your brain the injury occurred. If it occurred in your cerebellum or your brainstem, you're going to have problems with balance. If it occurred in your occipital lobe, you're going to have maybe problems with your eyes. If it occurred in your frontal lobe, you could have executive decision problems. You could have personality change problems. So it just depends. And if it occurred in two or three spots, which it can very easily, think whiplash with your head going back and forth. Both sides of your brain can be, or front or back can be damaged. So, I mean, you never know. And whatever part is damaged is where you're going to have the problems from. So, it's individual. And I wanted to tell you a quote here from a friend of mine, a survivor and author, David Grant, says this of traumatic brain injury. It is a lifetime of recovery. And anybody who has a brain injury, anybody living with anyone with a brain injury, pretty much knows that's true. It is a lifetime of recovery. So, Megan, I'm going to start with you. What do you think about your recovery? What kind of improvement have you had? And do you still see improvements happening? And if so, can you talk about them? I know I gave you three questions. So what do you think about your recovery? Okay, you got it?
I think I would describe my recovery as nonlinear. I think, you know, you start slowly improving and then there's setbacks. You know, I remember when I first got sick, when I had a major brain flare in 2014, you know, I couldn't tell time. I couldn't read anything longer than a sentence because my short-term memory was so bad. And, you know, I'm thankful every day that that's no longer the case. But it wasn't like I woke up one day and I was suddenly better. It was something that took a lot of time. And I would say, you know, I was mostly recovered 2 years after I first got sick with it. In those 2 years, what really helped me the most with my recovery is just resting and being patient with myself. And, you know, even today, I do have some residual issues. I have some short-term memory loss, and sometimes I have trouble focusing. And I just have to remind myself to be patient.
That is really good advice, Megan, because I think that's one of the things that's so difficult for folks because they want to get their old life back. You know, they want what they had before. And brain injury strips so much of that away from the survivor. And it's hard to be patient. You know, it's hard to say, okay, you know, it's hard to even believe the doctors that you're going to get better when you're in such a state. David was, when he saw his doctor 6 months after, his doctor said he thought he would get back to about 95%. And I thought, oh, my gosh. He said not, but he didn't say how long. He said it would take some time. He didn't say how long. And I thought, well, that's not good enough. You should be up to, you know, 100% better. When you break your arm, it heals, and you get to 100% better on your arm normally. So why not with a brain injury? But, well, I've learned the long, hard way that that's not the case. It doesn't just get better. And frankly, at this point, I wish David had got to 95%. The doctor didn't estimate correctly, and it's not his fault. You know, it's just they're doing the best they can on how this actually is going to affect. Because, frankly, brain injury and the study of it and the understanding of it through doctors and scientists is, I'd say, relatively new. Meaning many, many years have gone by, but it hadn't been focused on as much in the past. Doctors would say, oh, you bumped your head, you've got a concussion. Oh, you've seen stars, you've got a concussion. Go home, rest, and be done with it. And I don't think they realized the implications that has with a survivor, that it can be a long-term thing, like you mentioned, Megan, with, you know, you had short-term memory loss. You know, and that wasn't ever documented back then, way back when. And I'm talking about when I was younger, when I was growing up, and that's a lot of years ago. Think dinosaurs. And so, you know, we just have to understand that if you can be patient, it's going to be better because this is not going to be an easy fix in any way, shape, or form. So, Elizabeth, let's look at this question through your lens as a caregiver. I'd also like your thoughts as a professional therapist. So let me just, do you want me to say this question over again? Because it's been a while now.
Yeah, that would be great.
What did you think of, I think it probably would be. What do you think about Frank's recovery? You know what? Before we even do that, let's, Can you give us just a short intro of what happened and how you did become a caregiver and what happened to Frank so people understand what we're talking about and how it's affecting both of you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So Frank's injury was in 2012. He was a police officer and was just doing his normal job. But because we live in Minnesota in the winters, it's a little, you know, there can be different things. And he was just driving down the road. They were in looking for a fugitive is an aggressive word, but they were looking for somebody that they needed to apprehend. And unfortunately, he lost control of his vehicle and slammed into a tree. Frank was airlifted out after having a chunk of time, clearly not breathing. And actually, his partner was the one who found him and helped to extricate him out of the car. And when I was notified and got to the hospital, he was in really bad shape. You know, he took the brunt of it. He was very lucky. Frank was a big guy. And so the car essentially bent around the tree. And although we're not sure where his impact was, but because he was a big guy and had his vest on, his car kind of crushed around him. But he did slam his head into his computer. You know, cops have that computer system that's kind of mounted in their vehicle, and they think that's what hit him in the head. And so they had told me that evening that, you know, if he survived, that he was going to be in tough shape, or could be, you know, the prediction was that he would be in tough shape. And I was a brain injury specialist at that time. However, I did not work in acute care. I worked kind of in post-acute, which is after people have had injuries, and they're kind of in that, you know, about a month after or so in that kind of that recovery period. So that's where my specialty area, not in this acute, scary phase. And so Frank spent a couple months in the hospital and went from he's not going to live to a miraculous recovery. So his trajectory was incredibly high and incredibly fast. And before we left the hospital, physically, he was doing football drills, and so they were having him, you know, run and then pivot and catch footballs, which was great for him because he was used to being at the gym and being an athlete. His main areas of concern really were cognitive, and so he was able to speak, but his short-term memory and his it's called executive skills, which are those higher processing pieces of information, were impaired. He rehabbed for 3 years, really wanting to go back to be a police officer. That was his life's passion. Unfortunately, he was not able to do that. And it's still to this day. So now we are no longer married. The brain injury really did have a significant impact on his personality, which it can. And, but we are not on bad terms. So it was a financial and safety decision for us. However, I talk to him all the time. I am still his medical decision maker. You know, we are still very close, and we have children together. So we still, you know, we have a lot of contact, and I am still there. But I think that one of the biggest factors that people, you know, from a caregiver and from a clinician standpoint, because I am a speech therapist, it is incredibly difficult to try to reconcile the person you knew, the person they are now, and the person they're fighting against. And so there's some of that play within themselves. And then, of course, you as a human being are also playing in your head with, well, these are things they could do before, and now they can't do them, which can be both sad and frustrating. And so there's a lot. There's a lot of components. Brain injury is incredibly complicated, and I don't think anybody ever understands until they're living either with someone or with somebody that – or an individual who has one themselves.
Very well said. It was really interesting. Can you explain a little further about executive function? I think that's one thing that people may not quite get. And what does that entail?
So executive functioning are those things that we do every day they're a little bit more complicated. So we, you know, we know how to feed ourselves and we know how to go to the bathroom and we know how to put our clothes on. But there's things that are just higher processing. So if you're thinking about, let's say it's your grocery day and you want to go to the grocery store and you need to buy food. For myself, I would think, okay, so we're going to do tacos this week, we're going to have steak, and we're going to have hamburgers. So I would go and get the components of those because I can make all those little decisions. Okay, we need hamburger buns, we don't need ketchup, we need cheese. You know, my kids hate these kind of chips, I'm going to get these chips. Somebody that is struggling mm-hmm. with executive functioning could get into the grocery store and be so overwhelmed they don't know what to buy, and they could come home with a grapefruit and popcorn and then not know why they don't have any food for the week. So it's the executive skills or those executive functioning components really can be the tipping point and the struggle for some people. The tough part is that when somebody is looking, you know, concussions can often are impacted by these executive skills. And the example I have for that is there was a patient many years ago that she was I think she was the CEO of her own company. And so she had gotten into a bicycle accident and smacked her head pretty good, but had recovered very quickly, took about a week off, went back to work, and thought she was okay. But within 30 days, she had made so many critical errors that her business was failing. And I think that, you know, when you're in the hospital and they do, there's something called the mini mental. There's a couple of these quick questionnaires that they ask people and they say, oh, well, you're doing really great. Well, yes, you can remember what the blocks were. You know the colors. You can spell things backwards and you know how to calculate, money backwards from 100. You know, there's these little things we do, but that is an executive skill. That is just checking a quick check in all the different areas of our brain. Instead, we need to be looking at all of the different components that involve how quickly we remember something. What can we take from something we remembered a few minutes ago and can we change it up? How fast is that occurring? And if we don't take a look at those pieces, people are struggling and don't know why they're struggling. One of the things that we did at the hospital I used to work in before I left, as we talked earlier, I have COVID long haul, was that we created we took pieces of different testing that the speech therapists use that really poked at those areas. And we created a test that was a cluster of different tests that would tell us whether somebody was at risk. So it was a little bit of backwards thinking. Instead of, oh, they passed this test or they failed this kind of screening test that somebody had. So if they had a stroke or a brain injury or a concussion or lost consciousness, we would say, hey, we want to give you this screening test. And the nurses did that. So if they passed it, yet they had that diagnosis, we would come up and do this test. Because just because you passed a screening tool doesn't mean you can go back and manage your kid's soccer team or manage your checkbook or run your business. Yeah. It was really fascinating for us to learn and see those areas, and it was incredibly helpful to patients, and it allowed them to get into therapy sooner instead of waiting. You know, a lot of times when you have a brain injury, once you get out of the hospital, they have you follow up in about a month. Well, in a month, mm-hmm. you can train wreck a marriage, you can burn through your life savings, you can lose your job, you can get a DUI, because your brain isn't working the same way, and this helped to circumvent that. We would get them into therapy much faster and start working on those areas that were difficult.
Wow, that sounds really fascinating. Is that something that they did at your hospital, or is that something that is common in other hospitals as well? Do you know?
I do know, and it is very uncommon. And I think because of I have brain injury in, you know, multiple different venues because it was something I was interested in. I was a dementia specialist. I became very fascinated with brain injury, and then my husband had a brain injury. I really became absorbed and fascinated with it. And when I went to when I took the position at that hospital and we started to see these patients that were really struggling, post-injury, but were functional enough to go home and try to go back to work, as a team, we sat down and worked something out. I wish it was everywhere. We were CARF certified, which means we had special certification for brain injury, and we showed them that tool, and they actually called it out as a best practice. So I would hope that the rest of the world would do something like that. But, you know, medicine and healthcare is so cumbersome and so complex that we have to work with the masses. And I understand that from being a healthcare leader for so many years, but on the backside of somebody who had to wade through those trenches, it's very sad. And I watch families and I watch, mm-hmm. you know, patients having to struggle with those components. If you don't know, then you don't know, right? You don't know that that you're still struggling and why you're fighting with your spouse all the time is because you have a brain injury. Your brain isn't working correctly. And if you don't know and your spouse doesn't know that this emotional upheaval is because of that, it can cause a lot of damage to families.
Wow, yeah. Well, I guess there are some lucky ones there that that do get that care and do get had your, you know, your imprint on them for that. Thank you.
Yep.
Then, okay, this was my question now then, now that we know more about what you were doing and everything. What do you think about Frank's recovery? Do you think the doctors predicted his progress of healing correctly? And do you still see improvements happening with Frank?
They did not predict him correctly. If he was to live, he was going to be in a vegetative state. And so his injury was the very beginning. It was January 2nd. He was driving by May. So his recovery was absolutely astronomical. And he recovered for multiple years. I would say now we are in a phase where he is actually probably, he would never admit it, but incrementally declining. One of the risks with brain injury is that, and again, there's research that says this isn't true, but I've also seen it with patients. So, you know, sometimes it is what it is, but he is declining, and some patients have a higher risk for dementia type syndromes. I think the other issue is that for him, if he took another hit, you know, like if somebody hit him with a bat or he took a softball to the head, he would probably become very impaired. It is, uh-huh. There are days that I see him or he does things and it's just shocking to compare what I know his MRI looks like, because I've seen them and his CT scans of his brain, but just the fact that he is as functional as he is remarkable. They were shocked.
Well, that's good. That's a good story to hear, because that's not what we hear often. So,
yeah,
good. All right, I'm going to move on to another area. What do you think a survivor's or caregiver's biggest challenges is in making a family and friends and the general public understand what they're going through? Megan, you can probably pick that one up.
I would say a lot of it is just articulating it, because when it's happening to you, you don't always have the skills or the vocabulary to really say what's going on and to explain it to other people. You know, especially if it's something like executive function, you know, it's, for me, it felt like there's just kind of this fog, and, you know, I really couldn't think very far ahead when I was struggling with that. So putting into words what I was having trouble with and then explaining to other people was really beyond me. So I think, you know, just the explaining part itself. And then sometimes if you're sick enough, it's hard to see that you actually have a problem. You know, you don't even realize that you're forgetting things that you're forgetting. So that can be another issue. And I think, you know, from when you're dealing with people who have known you your whole life, like your friends and your family, they are used to one version of you, the version of you before you have a brain injury. And it can be very confusing for them why you're acting differently now and why you're not doing the things that you would do. and while you're forgetting, you know, birthdays, you're forgetting to show up to things, you know, they might, a lot of times they might take it personally. And so it's hard for them to kind of wrap their mind around that you're different. And sometimes even if you try your best to explain, they may not get it.
Yeah. I definitely get what you're saying there because, you know, with us, I know David's family, our family, understands that he went through a brain injury. You know, they were there. They were at his hospital bed for the first week. And they saw and they heard the doctors saying all these dire things that his he had a 1 in 600 chance of living and he they didn't know whether he would survive the next surgery and they didn't know what his level of capacity would be when he, you know, came out of the other end of this coma thing and out the other end of all the surgeries. So they were there. Yet I don't think people really understand what he has to go through every single day. Because, and even if they were to live with him, I still don't think they get it because you have to have a lot of communication, a lot of talking. And to tell you the truth, I wouldn't get it, all of it, if we didn't communicate and talk all the time about what's going on. Because I happen to know that every action that David does is choreographed, just about choreographed. When he knows when he's going to take a shower, what things have to go first, second, third, fourth, fifth, and they all have to happen. I'm talking to the teeniest detail of turning to pick up the soap, turning back to put the soap back. You know, some things like that that nobody would even dream that anybody is thinking about because those of us with no brain injury don't give it a second thought. You know, we don't even, you know, you just pick up the soap and you just move on and you go on. But somebody who is being inhibited by all of that, it's very difficult. When he is walking across the floor, he is thinking about every single step he takes to keep his balance. When he's chewing his food, he has to think about every bite he takes and every chew he takes to the point where we no longer talk at dinner or any time that he's eating because it will cause him to either bite himself or cause him to a bad swallow, which causes a coughing spree. We just had one of those earlier today, you know, and it is just, and for me, it's hard because when I'm talking, I mean, if it's in my brain, it's out my mouth, you know, pretty fast. I like the, you know, instant communication and discussion, you know, that goes with that. And I've had to train myself to not talk when he's eating. And I sometimes do, and I sometimes, you know, am the cause of his having a coughing thing or biting himself, and I can see it on his face because his face just, you know, crunches up. He doesn't necessarily say anything. I don't think he wants me to know necessarily that I caused that pain. But it's hard to take. So it really is a challenge to make other people understand. And I'm saying this that even I am having the trouble, and I live with him. So it's really hard for our family and friends, even close family, to understand the things that a survivor goes through if they're not complaining about it. And nobody wants to listen if you do complain, so you're kind of in this catch-22 thing. Does anybody get that kind of a feeling?
This is Lissa. I agree with you completely. I think that it's very easy to become, I know I set up, I always called it scaffolding. Like our whole world had scaffolding built around Frank, and that if he was tired or angry or, you know, whatever was happening, then we would shift over a little bit and we would change things. And, you know, it worked, but when we were with other people, you know, I that's what I did, is I would make sure that he looked good and he, you know, felt comfortable, and that, you know, if I needed to, I could jump in. And I think the biggest moment for me to realize how different he was is when his sister came into town, and She hadn't spent a lot of time with him, but I needed help at that time. That was before we were separated, but we weren't divorced. And she kind of went off on her own for a little while and called me later, and she said, I had no idea how difficult this is. And she'd been with him for maybe 5 hours. And I think that's the hard part. You know, people don't understand the brain power it takes if you're the caregiver to, exactly like what you were discussing, like the showers or the, you know, everything has such, you have to think about things that nobody else has to think about. And it is, it's exhausting. It's exhausting for them and it's exhausting for the caregiver.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a big part of why I live alone. You know, I think it's just easier to have things the way that I need them and the way that I want them. Yep. You know, I think it'd be very difficult if I had someone else in the house, for example, maybe waking up at a time where I needed to be asleep or, you know, like making noise when I needed quiet. You know, I think people, especially when they don't live with you, they don't realize how much it affects so much of your life.
Mm-hmm. That is so true, Megan. And I think even if they do spend time with you, they still don't get it because mm-hmm. they're not so focused in on the survivor. I mean, I am focused in on David's needs and his life constantly. I mean, and we're talking more than 17 years. Now, it's different than the first 5 years when I was on 24/7. I'm not saying I'm on 24/7 now because I'm not, but his needs and his well-being is never far from my brain. It's never far from my thoughts. And
right.
The thing is, I don't have to be on alert as much as I was in the beginning because he does have some independence in the house, but he relies on me for so many things. Yet, saying that, he tries to take care of most things himself. He relies on me for the things that he is simply not able to do because of his brain injury. You know, he does pick up a lot of the slack in the house for different things like laundry. He does laundry. And that gives me time, you know, to do other things. He does the dishes after dinner at night. I do the cooking because I would not want to eat onion sandwiches every day. And frankly, he can't even do that anymore because he can't cut the onion. But that's what David would be his form of dinner, onion sandwich on white bread. But so he's not even able, you know, to do that anymore. But you know, just all of these things wear him out. You mentioned it was exhausting. They wear you out when you have to have your brain on every single second. Thinking about, well, if I take this step and I do it this way, I'm going to fall. If I do it this way, I can do it, you know, or, you know, just everything. It's just amazing what people with a brain injury have to go through that the rest of us don't even have a clue about. And I think that's the reason why we're sitting here talking about this, so that maybe somebody who's listening to this will get it. And if only one person gets it, that's one person more in the world that can understand a little bit more about brain injury, and that's good. So if anybody has any other comments on that one, I'm going to move on. If not, okay. I wanted to talk about that there are so many issues that accompany brain injury, and I've jotted down a few of them. So I'm just going to pick out a few of those. And these are issues that affect the cognitive thinking brain. So I'm not talking about the physical issues right now, but just the mental issues, the cognitive issues. And one of them is, well, I'll just go down, attention and filtering issues. People have a hard time keeping their attention things or filtering out other things so that they can focus in on something. Short-term memory loss, which is one of the things that you mentioned earlier, Megan. Information processing issues. That is a lot to do with the executive functioning that we were talking about a few minutes ago as well. Difficulty with problem solving. Again, that would be your executive functioning. because you have to look at a problem and solve it. And there's not always one way to solve it. You might have to go around in a different manner to figure out a way to get this problem to the liking that you want. Problems with organization, that's a huge thing that people with brain injury have. And Elizabeth, you were talking about that person who was trying to get her business back, and she just was unable to because she didn't have the skills anymore to do that. And that's kind of an interesting thing to see something, to somebody who was a good business person beforehand and is not able to execute that anymore. It's bad. Difficulty with judgment and decision-making. Again, there's the executive functioning. Problems with higher-level thinking skills known as the executive skills. And there you go. All of those, many of those that I just talked about were higher-level thinking skills. So, Megan, what do you find are the most debilitating cognitive issues that you must face since your brain injury?
I would say definitely the short-term memory loss. There's a lot of times where, I forget to do something, take something off the stove. Or, there's a lot of times during a conversation where somebody's telling a story and I have to ask them to circle back to the beginning of the story so that I remember everybody's name. So that's definitely been difficult. It's also difficult for, kind of memorizing, let's say if like somebody is reading me a phone number over the phone, I have trouble kind of like writing that down in time before I forget it. So that's been a little difficult too. And I think the other thing that's really hard is probably, and this kind of comes and goes for me, like focusing. Sometimes I'm like really focused and I get things done and I'd be able to concentrate on something for, a while. And then other times it's just like pulling teeth, to get me to do what I need to do. And it's very frustrating because I'll set aside some time to, for example, write or send out emails. And because I'm unable to concentrate, like very little of it gets done. So it ends up, the task ends up taking a lot more time than I thought that I, originally allotted for it.
Yeah. And do you get, does the frustration come in at that point then too, that you weren't able to do it?
I think it sometimes comes in, but I think I've learned to be patient with myself that, this is just how it is, I have trouble with this sometimes and I just need to be patient with myself. Being frustrated, I've realized, doesn't make the task, pass any faster. If anything, it's another waste of time.
All right. I was going to ask you if you had any tips on how you get through those. But I think you kind of gave it to me with patience and being, self-aware about what you need for yourself. But how about like when you said sometimes you forget about the stove? Are there any ways that you, any things you do to help that not to happen? Because that would be a very dangerous one.
That can be a very dangerous one. I've certainly eaten a lot of bad cooking because of that. So sometimes, just the memory of that is like, oh, man, I don't want to do that again. But I think setting a timer. And then the other thing, if I walk away from the stove, I tell myself, I have a specific task in mind. For example, if I'm cooking oatmeal in the morning for breakfast, I'm like, okay, I'm just going to wash my face, nothing else, and then I'm going to go right back. So sometimes that helps. The other thing that I'll do occasionally is I'll leave something that I need by the stove. So for example, I'm cooking oatmeal in the morning and I usually, wash my face and then I do my makeup. So I might leave like my foundation or like another part of like my makeup kit by the stove. That way I have to go back to it.
Okay. Those are good. Those are good little tidbits to for other people to use, something like that. I like your timer one for sure. So that timer is going to go off, and it's definitely going to alert you as long as you don't hit the pause, and just ignore it. or turn it off and say, okay, now I remember, because you don't. I use my timer a lot for everything, and mostly it's because I'm going in 10 different directions at once. And I know if I say, okay, I'm going to, I just need these eggs to boil for 10 minutes. They can go for 10 or 20 or 50 minutes, you know. Of course, I would never do that because the water would boil out. But, you know, and I'd have a problem because I will get distracted because of other things that I need to do. So I think the timer works for me the best. I like your other little tricks, though, of dropping things nearby. I sometimes do that when I'm going out on, and I don't have a brain injury. This is just some tips that I use for me because I do some of these things. And if I know I'm going to be going out, I'll put my water bottle near my purse, you know, or because sometimes I've forgotten my purse in the house and have to get out to the car and it won't open because the car keys are still in the house. So it's like, okay, you've got to put your things together and so that you have what you need. David often will yell out to me, Donna. He goes, Donna, do you have your purse? Do you have your phone? Do you have your bag? You know, and I go, yes, yes, yes. Okay, you can go. So, you know, so whatever works, you know, whatever works for you. I've got to find little tips, but I'm hoping that somebody can pick up on the tips that we're talking about now and maybe use some of them to help them to become more organized in that thing, or more remember better in that, you know, whatever it is.
More independent.
For me, exactly. Elizabeth, how about you? What are your thoughts on the most debilitating cognitive issues that you saw in Frank? Or some of your patients, too.
Yeah, I think memory is really difficult, and particularly when people are adamant that either something has happened or hasn't happened, because that can make them feel really stupid. They just feel like, well, of course I did this, or of course we didn't do this, and it's really difficult. You know, you feel for the person because you know that they truly believe what they're saying or what they're doing, yet it's still correct. And arguing with them isn't going to make it better. And sometimes it can just escalate something into anger, which you don't want. So it can be really tough. Memory, short-term memory in particular, is a tough one. I know with Frank, he would get really frustrated when he felt like I was telling him something that was wrong, yet I knew it was correct. And it makes you feel, as a caregiver, it made me feel bad. You know, I felt bad for him, and I felt bad that he was going through that, but there also wasn't a whole lot I could do about it. You know, it was, you know, if it was something that I could just let go, then I would let it go. But if it was something that was really important or that he needed to know or he needed to understand, you know, it really could make him very frustrated.
I get it. Thank you. Okay, we're going to move on to another topic here. Many survivors of brain injury, well, it's kind of just the opposite of the topic we just talked about, but many are affected with numerous physical disabilities. And, for example, my husband David is afflicted with many of those. We were talking about memory loss, and we were talking about all the different cognitive thinking skills. And fortunately, that doesn't seem to affect him, which is, you know, we're very happy about the cognitive, the thinking skills, the executive functioning. He was not impaired in any of those ways, but he was impaired in many physical ways and has many physical disabilities to prove it. So, I think his greatest loss is his compromised balance. And before the show, I actually wanted to talk to him again because we talked many, many times, but I wanted to actually talk to him again, but we ran out of time to see if there's anything else that he would ask, you know, add to that list. But for his compromised balance basically prohibits him from living an independent life. I mean, he does to an extent. He lives his independent life within his home within the walls of his home. He's basically a prisoner without bars. That's how we got the title for my book, because, you know, he can go out, but he can't go out, if you know what I mean. He can't because of, he's relying on me for any forays outside of the home. He's unable to walk outside alone because of stones, twigs, or uneven sidewalks. And any of those things will throw him off balance, you know, so that's really not good. And if that throws him off balance, he's in an instant, he'll be sprawled across the floor, or the ground, I guess I should say. Yeah, so his damaged eyesight also does not allow him to see clearly. So he often would miss a curb or a change in the grade on pavement. You know, you're walking along and you know how you get to a, this is a good example, a driveway. And sometimes you have the sidewalk going going level, and then there's this little dip to make the driveway down, so the curb doesn't, there's no curb, so, and then it's back up on the other side. Well, David would never be able to notice that. And so if you're walking and you're expecting a surface to be even and it drops a little bit, your brain usually can accommodate that. You know, you just make your step a little different, and it works for most people. But with somebody who is having problems with balance, it doesn't work. So his eyes don't see that. So he could, again, be careening to the ground because of that. So that's why David has to rely on me outside. He has to hold on to me all the time. And I'm basically, I always say I'm like his seeing eye wife, maybe, because I'm telling him there's a stone here, or I kick the stone out of the way, or there's a crack in the sidewalk, which I can't kick away. You know, there's a crack here. Be careful of that. Or the sidewalk is going to slant down, or sometimes it's bumpy, you know, and any of that stuff would just throw him off balance. But when he knows about it, when I'm telling him about it, he can be prepared for that, and then it helps a little bit. And he does have sight. He just, it's not clear, and he wouldn't pick up on that. So I think his greatest deficit from his brain injury would be his loss of his independence. Probably, and like I said, I wanted to talk to him earlier about it, and I haven't, so perhaps after the show I will, and see if there is any difference or change in that. But that's what I feel that his greatest deficit is. Although I talked earlier about his having to think constantly about every single thing he does, that's got to be very trying and very exhausting as well. But so that's why, you know, given that we were talking about that, I also want to go back and check with him and see, put these deficits in order. Which one is the worst? Which one, you know, is the least? Or are they all comparable? You know, I don't know. Well, I'm going to find that out. I'll share that with everybody on another show. But so, Elizabeth, what are your thoughts on the most debilitating physical issues that you see in Frank? And again, maybe your patients too.
Yeah. You know, I think for Frank in particular, his physical, you know, his physical is really good, but he does have balance issues as well that are, you know, he doesn't notice it, but every now and then it would catch him. You know, that's scary. I think the bigger component for most of my patients is, you know, some of them, balance is a big deal, or they lose the use of one of their hands. That's always very frustrating. And vision is a big one too. You know, people may be able to see correctly, but it's that either that distance judgment is off, or their Frank still has some double vision, just a touch. And I know that can be really frustrating, especially if they were big readers, mm-hmm. or they, you know, like to work on the computer a lot, and that can change a whole component of their life.
Yeah, definitely. Even though David has double vision, blurry vision, and he sees tilted, and that's what causes a lot of the problems outside walking, he will work on the computer, in fact, does every single day. I don't even know how he does that. I have no clue how, you know, right now I need a new lenses for my glasses or something, and I'm straining to see these words, and I make them really big so I can see. And he's got all these issues with his eyes, and I'm like, how do you do that? And going back to what Megan says, patience. He just sits there and he plugs away and he gets it done.
Yeah.
He may not get it done as fast as he did before his injury, but he gets it done, and he gets it done very, very well. So, you do whatever you can do to get through, I guess, you know, and you compensate. Basically, you do a lot of compensation. You try to figure out a way that is going to make your life easier in various aspects, especially things that are debilitating. Megan, do you have any physical disabilities that cause you a problem?
I do, actually. They're certainly not as significant as your husband's or Frank's, but something that I do struggle with is fatigue, to the point where
uh-huh.
I'm not able to really be awake a whole day. So I've had to rearrange my entire schedule essentially around managing my fatigue. So I wake up at 11 a.m. and, you know, everybody kind of knows in my circle and everybody at work knows, don't call her before 11 a.m. And I feel very lucky that I have the career that I have, you know, where I work for myself and I can kind of make my own hours. And then I have to go to bed at 11 p.m. So I'm really, you know, I really only have like 12 hours of being functional per day. And that's, you know, including all the other stuff that I have to do. Like, you know, 11 a.m. Mm-hmm. I wake up, takes me about an hour to get ready. I have to start getting ready for bed at 10 a.m. or 10 p.m. And, you know, I still have to do regular people things in between, like, you know, cook dinner, eat meals, take care of housework and shopping, that sort of thing. So that's been, mm-hmm. you know, that's been my biggest issue with managing. I think I do also have some residual balance issues. You know, I think last year, I believe, I was riding a bike and went over the handlebars. So that's definitely something that I'm not going to do alone again. You know, I started taking a Pilates class because it's very gentle exercise. It's the type of exercise that I'm able to handle with the fatigue. And there's definitely times in class where the instructor will be like, oh, you know, do this. And I'm looking at everybody else and I have no idea how they're doing it. It's like if you told me to do a backflip. Mm-hmm. So I'm pretty, you know, I can be really clueless about like how to balance, how to do like physical things in Pilates. It's very difficult for me now.
Interesting. Okay. And yet, in all of these things, you do have to compensate. You know, you find other ways around doing it. And I think with you, Megan, you made sure that your friends and family know that don't call you before this time because you're not going to be functional at that point.
Yes.
You need that time.
Mm-hmm.
And you also realize that you need those 12 hours of sleep in order to be able to get through your next day and do what you need to do. And now those are the kinds of things, I mean, that people have to consider and do for themselves. They have to, but it's, again, it's individual. For David, he sleeps 6 hours and he does pretty well on 6 hours. It's not great. And that's interrupted sleep.
Mm-hmm.
What he does is what he gets. But it sounds like, Megan, you probably wouldn't do well on 6 hours.
I definitely wouldn't. That would be like maybe, you know, 2 to 4 hours for everybody else.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that he would prefer more, but his body doesn't allow him to take more sleep than that. So, you know, you just do what you have to do, and you accommodate, you adjust your life to work, to make it work best for you. And I think that's what everyone needs to figure out. Look at myself, look what I need, and go from there and try to work that out. So I want to talk about personality, too, because survivors are often affected by changes to their personality, which might include emotional or behavioral changes. And most folks who are not familiar with these deficits have a hard time understanding them. They don't understand why their loved one is acting that way. And Megan, you kind of alluded to that a few minutes ago. So how can we as advocates of brain injury explain that behavior? And I say we, all of us, because Megan, as a survivor, you are definitely an advocate for the brain injury community, and Elizabeth and I as caregivers are. So our focuses may be just slightly askew from each other, but we all have the same goal, is to help people to understand. So how can we as advocates of brain injury explain the difference in what happened to the behavior, if that's happened, or whenever it happens to people, because it does a lot.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
No, I'm done. Go ahead, Megan.
Oh, you know, I think it's almost like invasion of the body's natures a little bit. You have to understand that, you know, the person that you know has had some changes happen to them, and they may not be acting like themselves. And it really doesn't help to just be like, hey, you need to start acting like yourself again. You know, because we don't know how. We don't know how to do that. You know, either we don't remember, or we're not physically able or mentally able to do it. And I think the best thing you can do as a caregiver or a friend or a family member is just kind of pay attention and try to see what this person needs. And I think if you're clinging to this old version of who this person needs to be or who this person was, it's going to be very frustrating for you. And I understand there's a lot of grief involved because, you know, you feel like you're losing someone, but imagine what it's like when the person that you're losing is yourself, when you know you should be acting a certain way, but you're not able to. And, you know, you used to like things and you just don't like them anymore. So I think just having compassion and empathy for the person going through it is really the best you can do.
That is really good advice. Yeah, because, and I was touched by the fact that you're saying, you know, as caregivers or as family members, we do see a loss of the person that we once knew. But you have to also think how the survivor must feel. That's, I mean, I didn't change in my life. You know, I altered my life, but I didn't have my life torn away from me and changed, whereas David did. And that can be, you know, I guess you can, I mean, I know you can have the grief over losing yourself, losing. And I know a lot of people that do that, where they just can't even accept the fact that they can no longer be the person they were before. And that makes it even more difficult, I think, for the healing process. I think one of the things, and I can think it all I want, it's not easy to do, is for people to use those compensations, figure out who you are as a new person. If you think about it, you changed a lot through your whole life. As an adult, you've changed from that child, and you can't take that child back. You can't be that child again, even though you want to be that child again. You can't. And if you might have liked yourself as a teenager a whole lot, but that's gone too. So you are going through changes all the time in your life. But it's a little more, well, it's a lot more difficult when the change happens in an instant, you know, the childhood into teenage, into young adulthood, et cetera, to the elderly years, happens over a long period of time, and you're just living through life, and it's happening. And one day you wake up and you say, well, how did I get to be this old? You know, but it didn't happen overnight. And what happens with a brain injury, oftentimes, it's most of the time, it is an overnight change. You know, you go to bed one night and you wake up the next night somebody different, somebody that you don't even necessarily recognize as the survivor, I'm talking. Of course, that happens also for the caregiver to not recognize that person. But that's got to be really, really difficult to be able to have to say, whoa, where did this other person go? And your idea of the body snatchers is really good, because it's almost like somebody came in and took the old person and inserted a new person that is completely different. And everyone has to get used to this new person, whoever he or she might be. And you have to, you know, make the accommodations, I keep saying that word, to incorporate that new life into the old life that you already had, if that makes any sense at all. So on that note, we are already getting up to our time and I have to start closing down. And I only got through half the show. And I was up till 4 o'clock last night working on it because I went to the beach instead of working on it yesterday during the day. So, but it was worth it. It was worth it, fun. Anyhow, I had a really great time talking with you, Elizabeth and Megan. And I thank you for coming onto the show, and I hope that you will come back again soon and we can have some more chats about whatever. But
absolutely.
So I'm going to say thanks. Great. Thank you to Elizabeth Bonafide. Did I say that right? I always ask you, and I write it down, and then I never look.
It's Bonafide.
Bonafide. Okay. Okay. I think I'm going to put it in my brain this time and keep it. So anyhow, thank you, Elizabeth Bonafide and Megan Beaudry, for sharing, again, so much of your life and offering hope to other survivors and caregivers and just letting them in on, you know, who you are and what you've experienced and how it's worked for you. You can always learn more about Megan Beaudry and Elizabeth Bonafide at my website, survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com, and just poke their names in the sidebar, search box. Okay. You can read the interviews of other TBI survivors and caregivers on my blog at, again, survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com, all one word, all lowercase. And on that website, you're going to find tons and tons of things for brain injury resources, big itty-bitty giant steps, all kinds of things. You'll also be able to read more about my book, Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Tale, at my website, which is DonnaFigurski.com. If you just put Donna Figurski or Donna O'Donnell Figurski into Google, like I said earlier, you're going to come up with so many things, more than you may ever have wanted to know. But go ahead and take a peek. It's out there for a reason. So anyway, on the next show, I'm going to be interviewing caregiver and author Greg Payen. He is the author of a book about his wife who had a brain injury, and it's called Please Stay. Oh, I really love that title because that's what I said to David's surgeon every time he went for things. If you don't come back to me, I'll never forgive you. I whispered that to David. Please give him to the surgeon. Please give him back to me. Please. So I understand Greg's sentiment there when his wife Holly had a brain injury and he just said, please stay. And I'm going to give you the happy ending. She did stay. So remember to tune in every first and third Sunday to hear my show, Another Fork in the Road. And don't forget the second and fourth Sundays at 5:30 p.m. Pacific time to listen to Lisa Dreyer. She is the host of Mess with MS. So after, I think Matt Duffin should be following me on this show now. And on the next show, so stay tuned. And, if you loved my show, please tell 10 of your friends. If you hated it, well, tell 10 of your enemies. That works for me, too. So I'll see you next time on August 21 when I'll be celebrating my daughter's birthday. And I kind of figure it's my birthday, too, because we both did that day together. So, So on August 21st at 5:30 p.m. Pacific time, I will see you again, same time, same station. And I'm going to say goodnight to everybody. Thank you again, Megan. Thank you, Elizabeth. I really had fun chatting. Good night, everybody.
Thank you.
Good night, world.
Good night.
Good night.